It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore hemp-derived products now, grown on a farm near the village of Cambridge, and a model for indigenous-led cannabis companies to get established in the industry. Join this conversation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts as they come up, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Jane Oatman is Executive Director of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association and the Indigenous Cannabis Coalition. She is an enrolled member of Idaho's Nez Perce Tribe. Mary Jane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Tots. May we, everyone.
Good morning. And Rob Perro here, founder of the CBD brand Candigenous, a hemp grower and owner of an apothecary in Cambridge and an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Rob, welcome.
Uju, thank you so much for having us. We're so excited to be here and talking cannabis.
Well, good. So, Rob, let's start with you because you became licensed to grow hemp in 2019 after the federal farm bill legalized the cultivation of industrial hemp, and you've finished your third season of cultivation. What have you learned in farming hemp?
This is really hard.
in just a few words, this is very hard.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's an emerging industry for me. You know, I didn't grow up farming, so, you know, I threw my hat into the ring in 2019, and, you know, we've had actually 2019 was our first grow, but as Candigenous, 20, 21 and 22, this is our third year as Candigenous growing. It's a very difficult industry to be in. There's a lot of things to watch out for, but it's also really exciting to be a part of something new.
How much hemp are you cultivating?
2 years ago, we did a 10,000 plant grow, about 10 acres, which was really our first kind of grow into the market where we were growing for flower and growing to extract for distillate and oil. So that was a massive grow. You know, we had taken out a loan through WIDA, had worked with some partners to develop a business plan. So we are still working on some of the oil from that grow from 2020. And in 2021 and 2022, we have been growing smaller grows, about 1 acre to 2 acres of boutique smokable flower.
What values have you placed on how you treat the land as you grow this crop?
Oh, man. You know, it's there's a sort of a theme that which we kind of mold our business after, and it's an old Ojibwe kind of motto that everything that you do, whether, you know, it's making your bed in the morning or, you know, how you talk to your family or driving to work, you got to make sure you do it in a good way. And it's a simple, you know, kind of way of living, but it's the way that we have moved forward with our brand and our processes for Candigenous. And the goal being to really provide a product that has transparency behind it, that has integrity behind it, that people actually know what they're putting in their body. And right now in our current market, there's a bit of a lack of transparency and clarity as to what exactly we're ingesting here. So our goal was to provide some credibility in the space.
Mary Jane, how were you introduced through your family to plant medicines, including cannabis?
It's been in my family for quite a while. I mean, I've had just some of my earliest memories around it with my uncles and my grandfathers. But I also remember when my grandma went to federal prison for growing when I was a little girl. So it's been a part of my life and really a big imprint since as long as I can remember. And my mom, she used cannabis while she was pregnant with all six of her children, healthy, happy, productive, contributing members of our community. So I would say my mom was a pioneer in some of the research of cannabis as a young woman trying to figure out how she chose her own medication and really pushed back against pharmaceuticals.
And you bring up the tension there that, you know, THC is not classified as a Schedule I drug, you know, due to the farm bill, which legalized the production, but marijuana is classified as a Schedule I drug. How does that affect production? How does that affect business in Native communities?
For the Nez Perce tribe, we're out here in Idaho where there is no legal form of marijuana legalization. And in a checkerboard reservation homeland where it's always a battle over jurisdiction, over power, it's always going to create that friction between our tribal communities and our non-tribal communities. The conversation has definitely started to change, you know, quite a bit. But I think that the political will, lack of alignment in the different communities has definitely been a game changer for tribal communities to be able to look deeper into the articles of their treaty, for instance, around trade and travel, or really dig deeper into the United States Constitution itself around Indian commerce and trade. This cannabis has been a game changer for tribes to open up economic development conversations overall.
Mm. Talking about Indigenous cannabis and hemp use and businesses, Mary Jane Oatman there, Executive Director of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. We also have Rob Perro with us, founder of the association and a hemp grower and retailer in the Cambridge area. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Rob, what is your view there as Mary Jane lays out that the friction, as she says, and how you navigate, you know, sovereignty rights, you know, and what governments can do in developing cannabis policies and how it affects Native people?
Yeah, well, that's there's a lot there, right? And I think where we have to start it is with education and, you know, educating, you know, about this plant and, you know, all the different aspects of the plant. When we talk about, you know, hemp and marijuana, those are vastly different. So I think starting there with data is where we really dug in to really level up, you know, our tribal governments and our tribal business leaders to be educated in this space. You know, we can all talk about it because we've all kind of had ancillary experiences with it over time. But specific to, you know, moving policy and regulation and legislation, you know, that's where the data is really important for us to overcome some of the obstacles that are out there. So I think education is the number one goal for us through ICIA and the work that we're doing with our just the community at large, but also the tribal community to get them up to speed so that they can make good decisions for the benefit of their community, knowing that this industry is coming, whether we all like it or not.
Right, because hemp has become a more viable product for farmers, including indigenous farmers, and viable for a company. What benefits do you see does the cannabis industry offer entrepreneurial tribal members?
Oh, just to follow a passion, you know, and I think cannabis is a passion for a lot of people, and it's been a sanctuary for most, you know, for their own healing. You know, that's outside of the pharmaceutical world. And, you know, I talked to, you know, a young relative of mine at a holiday party this last weekend who was 19 and not going to school and, you know, smoking pot, which is exactly what I was doing when I was 19 years old. But now there's a viable opportunity with, you know, even programming in our own state university system at Platteville where we have cannabis certificates in business, you know, ag and testing. So there are now opportunities if you really want to get your hands dirty in this space to do it. But it doesn't mean it's easy. You know, it's still hard work and people still have to move the needle in their own space, you know, to get into this industry. And it's not an easy space to be in, but it's an exciting space because there's not a lot of people operating in it.
Rob Perro is founder of Wisconsin's first Indigenous-led CBD and hemp business. Mary Jane Oatman is with us, leads Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. Join a conversation about First Nations getting a stake in the cannabis industry. Call with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the Wisconsin-based Indigenous-led business Candigenous and the work to promote cannabis startup companies led by Native entrepreneurs. Join in with your questions, your thoughts about First Nations in the hemp industry, 800-642-1234. Rob Perro is here. He heads up the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association and founded the CBD business, Candigenous, stays with us. Also, Mary Jane Oatman here heads up the association, which is a new network for tribes hosting cannabis businesses. Mary Jane, you lead this association. What are your goals for it?
You know, the biggest goals that we've had, you know, on the front line since we started is, you know, being evangelistic about the advocacy that we're doing for Indigenous communities internally within our own tribal community, you know, getting the unity in our community and externally with the other trade organizations and the other organizations that are looking to build sustainable, equitable, and inclusive cannabis policies so that we can partner up. And there are many that are excited for our presence and the empowerment of our Indigenous entrepreneurs, as well as our tribal nations to make bold moves. But as Rob was saying earlier, because we're in a position to invest early in data to capture that now, the qualitative as well as the quantitative data, so that we can be strategic in how we move forward. But definitely connecting in this new year, our businesses, our aspiring entrepreneurs, as well as our industry partners, because we can learn a lot from each other. Our new and beginning farmers should not have to step on landmines when they can be networking with others that can share their knowledge.
Mary Jane, what do Indigenous entrepreneurs need the most? What is lacking in their world that is desperately needed?
Desperately needed, like mainstream everywhere in the cannabis industry, are tangible, realistic banking solutions. Access to capital is the overriding challenge for pretty much everyone in the industry, but non-predatory access to capital, I would put in there as a disclaimer as well. And then the supplemental skills. Most of our legacy cannabis communities know how to do business, but we need the guardrails for regulatory and compliant, safe community access to these products. And so we need to build them the technical assistance and the resources on how to build compliance systems, the track and trace, showing the how to work within the legal framework.
Rob, how did you get the access to capital to start your hemp cultivation?
Yeah, I was going to add on to that, you know, that I think mentorship in that space is huge, you know, for Indigenous entrepreneurs. And for me specifically, I was very lucky to have a great resource in the American Indian Chamber of Commerce of Wisconsin. Gary Mehar, Craig Anderson, Bill Bisson, you know, all these sort of OG Native business leaders that have been, you know, sort of guiding the ship over the years in Wisconsin. Our chamber's 30 years old. So when I came in with, you know, a new idea, and I come from media and production and consulting, they helped me, you know, and that I think is the first step, is asking for help. And knowing that there's resources out there, if you just look for them, they're willing to be there for you. So, you know, I asked for help. I had them sit down and help me create a business plan, help me, you know, find ways to pull those levers of accessing capital to move forward with what my dreams were. And, you know, we did that. You know, we accessed about $200,000 in capital through the SBA and WIDA as part of our business plan. And I would not have been able to do that alone.
When I think about your 10,000 plants, 10 acres that first year, you were taking on risk. And I'm wondering, like, farmers normally buy crop insurance. Could you buy crop insurance for industrial hemp like other farmers do?
You can, but it's a very turbulent market there as well because they don't know how to underwrite it. That's all evolving as we kind of move into this industry and understand what supply chain and distribution looks like and what also the risks are, you know, that are there when you are farming a crop like this, because it's not just weather, it's also poaching and it's mold and it's pollination. So there's a lot of things to look out for, and you know, that's where, you know, the banking, the insurance, the finance, you know, sector of our cannabis industry really needs to get up to speed to support us. Just in regards to capacity and peace of mind, so that we're not taking on as much risk and we can make this a more attractive industry to get into.
You, last month, the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association had its first summit in Washington, D.C. What did you learn about the industry from holding a national summit?
What did I learn? I learned that there's a need for more of this, and that the idea of getting organized specifically around our tribal communities, you know, is a necessity. It's a necessity just in the idea of, you know, idea sharing and problem solving. So it was amazing to be a part of something as special as that, you know, the first ever Indigenous DC Policy Summit, you know, led by Indigenous for Indigenous, but also being, you know, inclusive of our non-Native partners, understanding that, you know, this is a community-based effort, and the only way that we're going to move forward is together in this, and that we're going to be able to fill the gaps of what our weaknesses and strengths are, you know, by truly networking, connecting together in this space. So it just showed me the power of numbers, and it showed me that there's so much more work to do, but so many people coming together to help with that work.
We're talking with Rob Perro, founder of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association, hemp grower, retailer in the Cambridge area. Mary Jane Oatman is here, executive director of the association, as we look at Indigenous cannabis and hemp use, the businesses, the spinoff, the startups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Mary Jane, you have attended the Marijuana Business Conference and Cannabis Expo, and you saw a concerning lack of diversity and equity. What problems came up for you? What did you see?
Excuse me. There is just an overall lack of that visibility. I think even, you know, a couple of steps further than that, in my earlier years of attending these MJ Biz Cons, started to notice a very palatable and uncomfortable flavor around cultural misappropriation in the cannabis industry. It was during that time, I believe, when they were getting ready to have the Land O'Lakes woman go missing from, you know, branding on the Land O'Lakes containers. Aunt Jemima was disappearing from the covers of the bottle of those maple syrup products. And then in the cannabis industry, as it's emerging and thriving and starting up, we're seeing an overuse of Indigenous and Native American specific symbolism, as well as naming in the cannabis branding and marketing portions of the cannabis industry, which is really, really disconcerting.
Do you take that on as an association? How do you address it?
As an association, we have not addressed it with any of these companies, no, you know, cease and desist letters, nothing of that sort. You know, unfortunately or fortunately for us, there's just been a lot of more conscious cannabis consumers that are just not accepting that. They think that it's a very distasteful, and those brands really don't get a lot of traction.
Are tribes using gaming compacts as a model for cannabis businesses? Do you see that, Mary Jane?
Early in Washington state, when they passed the I-502 legislation legalizing adult use recreational cannabis in Washington state, that was the model that was adopted early on by the Washington tribes. In Washington, they have very effective government-to-government consultation and relationships, and this just early on seemed like a win-win for the tribe, as well, all of the tribes in Washington, as well as the state of Washington. So they actually opted in for compacting in their state legislation. And the taxes from those compacts remain in the tribal community. What also is a benefit is the reciprocity of the testing of the products. Tribal products can go into the state market. State products can go into the tribal market. Hmm. So that reciprocity for public health and safety, I think, is really where their low-hanging fruit was on compacting in that specific state.
Let's pause there. Mary Jane Oatman leads the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. Rob Perro started Wisconsin's first Native American independently owned CBD business. You can join in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with a hemp entrepreneur who is a trailblazer for Indigenous-led cannabis businesses behind the CBD brand Candigenous. And we have the head of an advocacy group that works to lift up Native American entrepreneurs who are operating or starting up hemp businesses and apothecaries. Call in with your questions about the work in the hemp industry, 800-642-1234. Rob Perro, founder of Candigenous, with us, and Mary Jane Oatman of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. They stay with us. We heard from Tristan in Milwaukee, called in, and Tristan is wondering what's being done, Rob, to combat systemic racism in the cannabis industry, acknowledging, you know, the war on drugs, the generations-long war on drugs, that it's still, you know, prevalent in marginalized communities.
That's a great question, and that's something that, you know, we hold near and dear to our hearts with our BIPOC communities. As you know, when we talk about that DC summit and we look at the makeup of who was there, you know, a majority of our participants are you know, minorities. You know, these are people that, you know, have kind of been dealt a crappy deck and have been put in positions where the war on drugs really was put there to kind of keep certain people down. So, you know, the restorative justice aspect of what's happening now with social equity is massive, but it isn't gonna do what it's supposed to do unless we're all at the table helping make those decisions. So I think it's vitally important that our BIPOC communities are organizing, not just, you know, Indigenous, you know, associations working with other Indigenous, but everyone is crossing over and coming together for the greater good to really position, you know, our minority communities as leaders in this industry because we need it the most and deserve it the most. So there's a lot of work being done. It's tough work in that space because it can be somewhat divisive, but there's also a lot of advocates that support, you know, the movement of making sure that, you know, that restorative justice is being acknowledged and that our minority demographic is being put in positions to be successful in the cannabis industry. And right now there are a lot of barriers being put up, making it tough for entry. So a lot of work to be done, but we need the help.
As you mentioned, the financial barriers, that uphill battle of financial security, legal, and certainly connections in the industry that we've talked about. Let's bring on another caller, Dana in Appleton. Dana, hi.
Hello.
What would you like to bring? Sure. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I'm not an Indigenous person, but this has been a great public radio program because it's completely opened my eyes to something I didn't even know was an issue for Indigenous communities. As a non-member of the Indigenous community, how can I become more informed about the Candigenous issues and Indigenous person community issues more generally? I don't even know where to start, and I would love some advice. I certainly feel very aligned with the philosophies and methods of the Candigenous institution that I'm learning about today, but bigger picture, how can I learn more and be more supportive?
An ally. Mary Jane, you first, then Rob.
You know, I appreciate that question. We are definitely a, you know, values and visions aligned organization, and our allyship has really created a great tidal wave. So, you know, indigenouscannabis.org, our website, you can learn a lot about, you know, our advocacy empowerment policy work. Land acknowledgement is really a big thing for a part of that allyship. A lot of folks don't even realize that the sacred lands that they're walking on are the ancestral homelands of some Indigenous groups. So just, you know, looking at the soil that you're walking on, that you're working in as a farmer or sourcing for your medicine even, just looking a little bit more towards the land and the people whose lands they, you know, are, is a big step. So I'm sure that, you know, if the caller is from up there, you know, she's calling in from the ancestral homelands of one of our Wisconsin tribes, you know, and that type of connection. Aside from, you know, that there's a lot of different advocacy groups that are out there working on very specific issues, missing, murdered Indigenous women's groups that are focusing exclusively on that, climate environmental groups that are working on climate justice issues. And then, you know, we all at some points, you know, have this opportunity to interconnect each other's work, but there's definitely a lot of opportunities out there through the organizations. But I definitely encourage people to visit www.indigenouscannabis.org to support the work that we're doing through membership.
Thank you, Mary Jane, for that. And Rob, what comes up for you as you hear people say, I want to become more educated, more aware, more thoughtful on this issue?
I just say thank you. You know, I think we all have our own, you know, journey about, you know, where we come from and culture and, you know, what it means to be, you know, a United States citizen in this very young country. And there's a lot of history, you know, underneath our feet, you know, in our great state of Wisconsin too, that, you know, it just takes you peeling layers back and asking the questions and asking where can I go and what can I do? And there are so many resources. You know, first off, you know, go online and look up, you know, what tribes are in Wisconsin, you know, find out, you know, what Native American advocacy groups are in your area, because I guarantee that there are some. And, you know, the idea of coming into the Native community and asking questions and wanting to learn, we appreciate that, you know, and myself, as you know, I'm half Native American and half Polish German and love all those beautiful things. And for me, you know, my journey down, you know, that discovery of what it means to be Indian for me didn't start until my mid-30s. But it really is just asking the questions. And, you know, whether it's reaching out to myself or going to indigenouscannabis.org, there's so many resources out there. And we really are wanting to share our culture and traditions and answer those questions. So just ask.
It makes me wonder what you've learned from your customers in these early years through Candigenous. We haven't really talked fully about your CBD brand. What have you learned from customers?
I've learned that, you know, they have a lot of questions, and there's a lot of people that kind of come into this space that, you know, if they haven't been sort of lifelong consumers, they're very curious, and they want to kind of walk lightly into this space. And we want to kind of hold their hand, you know, along the way, because what we don't want is for people to come in and have, you know, a disingenuous experience with cannabis or hemp, when it's supposed to be, you know, a good, wellness-based experience. So, you know, we've just learned a lot. You know, there's a lot of inconsistency in the market and there's a lot of questions. So, you know, we take the time to, you know, walk through whether it be an experienced cannabis user and making sure that they're getting a product that's good for them, or a new cannabis user that's really looking for, you know, an alternative way to be well.
In the Indigenous community, seed saving is so important. And I'm wondering, how do you cultivate and save your hemp seeds, or in our tribe sharing seeds? What can you tell us?
Well, genetics is an amazing thing, you know. So the two strains that we grew this year, Pine Walker and Forbidden Bee, are seedless strains. For a reason, because there's a high value to seedless smokable flower in this space. So, you know, that kind of throws a wrench at your question because there's no seeds there.
But it certainly shows that, you know, I think of seeds as ways that you grow a plant. And yes. So if you don't grow them through seeds, how does that work?
Well, you can clone them. So you can, grow a portion of the plant and then, you know, take a piece of that off and, grow another one. So, you know, there's all sorts of science behind and genetics behind the cannabis plant in general and how to kind of, you know, get what you want out of it. And I think that's a really exciting space to be in, specifically for our indigenous communities, to put our own, you know, acumen and, science behind this, you know. So I think that's yet to be explored, but a very exciting opportunity for our indigenous communities.
Rob Perro with us, founder, entrepreneur, hemp grower, and retailer in the Cambridge, Wisconsin area. Mary Jane Oatman is here, executive director of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. And you, join in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Kathleen now in Steuben. Kathleen, hi.
Hello. Yes, I have a question about sacred lands and sacred burial sites, and how does the indigenous cannabis growing have, what is their response, or how do they react to regenerative agriculture as in contrast to factory farming and large factory farms?
Kathleen, yes, thank you. And Rob, that kind of goes along the lines where, as we were talking about farming, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, the idea of hemp and being an ag commodity, I think, is very interesting to the farming community at large in Wisconsin. And it was, you know, a big cash crop in Wisconsin, you know, kind of up until the 50s. It was one of the top cash crops in Wisconsin. So, you know, I think the question is, you know, what does that look like and what are the opportunities there? And, you know, specifically right now, the USDA is pumping a lot of money out there for these exploratory pilot projects. And specifically for Candigenous, what we were able to do was be a part of one of those grant programs for a climate smart fiber sourcing diverse workforce development grant through the USDA. So next year we'll be doing 100 acres of industrial hemp for fiber sourcing to develop a supply chain here in Wisconsin. Also generating carbon credits, and USDA is providing the TA and the resources to help us, you know, kind of get up to speed on what it's like to farm hemp as a commodity again. So, you know, specifically to that question, there's a lot of work to do, but the USDA is putting money out there for companies like myself to kind of be the pilots for the farmers at large in the state to see like what this industry can look like again. But in regards to sacred lands, you know, that's something that, you know, those continually, you know, continue to be discovered, as, you know, we've kind of seen throughout the news. And that's something that we're obviously mindful of with, you know, the land that we're growing on as well. But there's definitely some tribal monitoring, some cultural resource protection that will have to be done there as this industry continues to develop in our state.
I wonder how you view the potential uses for hemp. I mean, are there hundreds of uses for industrial hemp, thousands of uses? Do we even know all the uses?
I think right now we don't know. You know, it's so... such a massive iceberg, and we only see a couple ice cubes of, you know, medicinal and rec right now. And then when we talk about hemp, you know, we can talk about fiber, we can talk about hempcrete, we can talk about rebar and insulation, we can talk about medicine, biofuels. You know, there's so many applications, not just for hemp, but also for cannabis. So really it's almost unlimited at this point. Which is really exciting, because the idea of extracting all that data is also going to create a lot of jobs.
Rob Perro, founder of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association, hemp grower and apothecary owner in the Cambridge area. Mary Jane Oatman with us, executive director of the association, editor and publisher of the Tribal Hemp and Cannabis Magazine. Still time to talk about the hemp industry getting a toehold. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we look at the work to advocate for Native American tribes to get a stake in the cannabis industry, what that looks like. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Rob Perro is here, founder of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association and a hemp grower and apothecary owner in the Cambridge area. Mary Jane Oatman here as well, executive director of the association, and they stay with us. Mary Jane, we were talking earlier about legalization, cannabis illegal for medical and recreational uses under state law in Wisconsin. Gail from South Beaver Dam called in and is wondering if on a federal level, rescheduling marijuana, would that help address some of the barriers that you see in financial, legal, and otherwise to, industrial, to hemp production and becoming an entrepreneur in this industry?
Most definitely, Kate. The federal rescheduling specifically for tribes is imperative because our reservations are on federal lands. Indian reservations are designated as federal enclaves. And so if they don't have the safety around some of that federal language, many of our tribes will just not move forward. They fear jeopardizing their current federal programming. There are a lot of still adversarial relationships that are out there. Tribes have been disparate law enforcement action by federal officials already on tribal lands for cultivating hemp and cannabis since the Farm Bill. So that's just been the big no, it's not safe, we can't do this message for many tribes. So it does need to happen in specific language around keeping tribes away from state intervention. They should be able to move this economic arm of their tribal sovereignty forward without having any friction from state.
Hmm. Do tribal sovereignty rights as they exist today, do they provide these Native governments enough leeway, enough latitude in the development of cannabis policies?
The Farm Bill has really created a lot of, I guess you could say, the infrastructure for tribes, that's evolved and that's changed. And that's also what we're seeing within some of our state framework is, the lessons learned. And so, even on some of the federal language around how to interact within this state tribal framework, we can look to some of the current states that have already been legalized to find the nuances of what those best practices are so that we can create that leeway for the tribes to be able to develop. But there's definitely a lot more conversation and a lot more consultation with tribal governments that needs to happen at the federal level to move this forward. And that's really another thing that we're advocating for is government consultation.
Along those lines, Rob, we heard from Kiana in Baraboo called in, and Kiana wonders what you think of how the political will among Wisconsinites for marijuana has changed over the last few years.
Well, I think we're sick of seeing our money go to other states, and pay for the roads and schools and all the other programming they have in Illinois and Michigan. And that's about to happen in Minnesota too. So I think, as conservative as we may be in some aspects in Wisconsin, I think we need to think about this practically and understand where our money's going. So I think, even for the most conservative, you see what's happening, and something has to change there. So I think the sentiment is there, We've seen it, you know, through the election this past November that, you know, I think it's 70 to 80% in Wisconsin support full legalization. You know, so our representatives will listen to us, you know, and we're also doing that work on a state level as well to have those kind of intimate conversations. And again, you know, collecting the data, you know, we can't just run into this and yell as loud as we can. We need numbers. We need toolkits. We need legal. We need organization.
Meanwhile, in your products, how do you ensure limiting THC through your production and in your products? How do you do that quality control?
Well, we get tested. So before this year, it was the state was regulating our cannabis market in Wisconsin, and now it's USDA. So, you know, we go through a testing process to ensure that, you know, our hemp is, you know, below the 0.3%. And if it's not, we got to burn it, you know, so it's really, it's pretty black and white when it comes to that. But the integrity of our product beyond that, I think, is what's important, is the sort of the SOP or the quality control of what products are out there in our state of Wisconsin. And, you know, how are we tracking and sourcing where those products are coming from to make sure that they really are, you know, good for our bodies. And that's where we're trying to level up, which unfortunately we have to do in an unregulated market, is kind of put our own regulations in place.
In our last moments together, Rob, as you look at leveling up, what is the future of your business?
Oh, the future of my business is really exciting, in my opinion, because I don't know what that looks like. You know, the idea of, you know, if I could paint a picture and put everything right into it, you know, this picture is still being painted. And I think the space that we're in, specifically in the tribal communities, you know, to lead this industry is really the most exciting part for me, is to, you know, the more people that I can have around me that, you know, are moving in the same direction, I feel like there's success for everyone. There's enough room for everyone to be successful in this space and kind of cut their own path. So, you know, for me, it's about leveling everybody up, you know, increasing everyone's acumen in this space and providing the tools needed to create more business leaders, create more community leaders, and be inclusive of our non-native partners as well, because that's what we're gonna need to really take it to the next level.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. This was an awesome time.
Thank you.
Mary Jane Oatman, Executive Director of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. Rob Perreault founded the association and the CBD brand Candigenous. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.